Welcome everyone to What the Force, and welcome to A Power of Myth and Symbolism in Star Wars episode on mining. Yeah, that topic.
It's a weird topic. It's a really weird topic.
It's a really weird topic, and I'll do a little bit of setup about this. But first, welcome again, always, to the show, my co-host for this segment, Ty Black.
Hello, here to talk about the weird stuff. Usually it's about Reylo, right? I mean, usually it's kind of like...
It comes back to Reylo a lot. No, Masks was more about like hidden self and
true stuff,
but yeah.
Reylo or redemption. But I mean, this has parallel themes, I think, as weird as it is.
Mining is cool. No.
Mining is cool.
By mining, what do we mean? Well, in our world, to allow us to build things, pretty much anything in the world, we need to pull hard resources directly from the ground. So that's steel or stone to make concrete, you know, oil to actually build plastics or, you know, make our engines go.
Yep.
We need to mine resources to, you know, for fuel, unless it comes from like solar power. But for the most part, to live in our modern day society, we must consume to allow us to do that. And Ty and I, over the course of the last year, because we're actually on our year anniversary that we're recording this, we're on our year anniversary of knowing each other.
Yep.
Now, and we've noticed in the last year that there's actually a lot of in canon versions of mining and consumption from a resource perspective. Like,
yeah, well, and you've always said if it happens three times, it's a theme.
Yes.
And this has happened so many more times. I counted 63 mining planets in canon.
Whoa, 63. I only counted like the ones that were like pretty big from a story perspective.
Right.
There's been quite a few novelizations or novels that have actually pointed to one of the desires of, say, like the Empire being on a planet is to consume or to get resources to fuel the larger war or the larger control, right? And what are some examples that we've seen in canon, as, you know, we should probably talk about?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we obviously have like Kyber crystals. Our mind, but the way that the Jedi retrieve them is very different from how like the Galactic Empire retrieved Kyber crystals.
Exactly, like Jedha.
Like Jedha. Also, Ilum is the main source of Kyber crystals that the Jedi in modern canon actually know about. And there's also obviously, the construction of the Death Star, they mined Ilum almost to depletion, and they also mined Jedha almost to depletion and then destroyed the rest of Jedha to create the weapon for the Death Star. But they also mined the rings of Geonosis to complete the Death Star as far as like the metals, the precious metals go to construct it. So those are kind of like some of the main ones, but there's a lot more than that. And it's not always for the creation of weapons. So I find that really interesting.
For example, Lothal in the Thrawn novelization is mined for dunium, which is used to make ships particularly because it's lightweight and strong. And there's a lot of conversations about that.
Right.
We also get a castle, which is not only mined for more illicit reasons, which is spice, right? Which is an additive or a drug or enhancement, you know, drug.
Right.
Also coaxium, which is a fuel. Right. And so it supports like more illicit things because the Empire doesn't control Kessel specifically.
Right. Yeah, true. And again, like it's drugs, it's resources, it's, you know, there's most of them are depletable. So that's another interesting thing about it as well, because one of the themes that's driving these mines being brought up so explicitly over and over again is directly connects to the dark side and what the Sith have kind of created their entire ideology around, which is greed. And a really good word that keeps popping up in the sequel trilogy is hunger, right? We see it a lot in the novelization,
and like that they're never fulfilled, right? And that's right. That's like very much the control of the galaxy is ever consuming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, so much so that the First Order has been going out into the outer rim planets and the unknown regions and whatnot, doing God knows what, which we're getting more and more in canon now being revealed what exactly they are doing. But they're trying so hard to continue to consume. They're going further and further out into the universe to do it.
It's actually the basis of the entire plot of Resistance, in that they want to control the Colossus to be able to have a fueling station, because if they control the Colossus, they have fuel for all of their ships, and they have this way station, right, where they can control the fuel and be able to support their own expansion, right? A few other planets of note that we don't know much about their mining, but I think they're significant from a theme perspective, so I'm just going to mention them. In the Phasma novelization, the apocalyptic event that happened was the entire result of basically a corporate mining colonization of Parnassos. Mm-hmm. There was a corporation that brought in basically mining facilities and brought colonization there, and then it destroyed the entire planet, turning it into this apocalyptic wasteland. Mm-hmm. So that's super fascinating, because I just find that super interesting, and it was slowly killing the planet. Basically nobody could survive there. Two other planets of note that also have mining backgrounds, but we don't know very much about them, are mm-hmm. Jakku.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about Jakku more too.
Yeah. And Tatooine.
Yep.
The sand crawlers that the Jawas ride around in are mining vehicles.
Yeah.
And to me, that's just like, those two planets are at the core of some of the things that are happening in the saga itself. So those are at the core of some of the storytelling to do with the original saga, the prequels, and the sequel trilogy, is that like these planets have been in some ways used up and forgotten.
Yeah.
And they're nowhere. Nobody wants to go there. There's nothing for you to get there but the scraps.
Yeah. Yeah, literally nothing. That's a continual theme. Whenever they bring it up, they bring up exactly what mining has done to that planet and to that world. So something that this goes all the way back to the first film, right? Because the first time mining was ever mentioned at all was in the very first film, when C-3PO says to R2-D2, we're going to be sent to the mines of Kessel, smashed into who knows what. So it was very, very much established early on that there were mines. There was like this kind of like system. And not on top of that, he named it the Spice Mines of Kessel, because that was an obvious nod to Dune. Mm-hmm. You know, George Lucas was trying to pull in all of these other themes and these other stories into his myth, and he was very much influenced by Dune, so he did call it Spice Mines because of that. But then later on, he actually states that in the Clone Wars, in the cartoon, he states that spice was actually a drug. So from the time that he said Spice Mines of Kessel in the first film to the Clone Wars, there was never another mention of it as far as like what the spice mines actually were and what spice mm-hmm. was. It wasn't until Clone Wars where he decided it was a dangerous drug. Yeah, so that's really interesting to me.
I think that Clone Wars was very much the point in the time where Lucas decided to make everything in service of story. And you can tell that very, very clearly with the animation. Right. And that's like almost the cutoff of when things started to say, hey, let's actually tell the one story. It's all one story. Let's all tell the one story of Star Wars. And that's, I mean, the books didn't keep up to it, but that's why they're not canon, right? So anything that was kind of in the one story. But I think now is a good time to kind of say our quote for the episode, because I think that that's...
Yeah.
Like, now that we've kind of laid the groundwork, this is the idea that mining is continuously becoming an important theme, especially in the Disney era. Mines are brought up in almost every single canon piece of material. It's crazy when you actually start tracking them.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, so our kind of like metaphor that we're kind of going with is that like mining and consumption is a metaphor for the dark side of the force, because it directly represents the kind of that greed and hunger that dark side users have.
Never fulfilled,
They're
right? This,
never fulfilled.
yeah.
Yeah, there's the quick and easy path, if you will. And that quick and easy path eats up these resources that are essentially depletable. Whereas we'll get into kind of the opposite of that, and like what is the light side of it when it comes to this metaphor. And with that, I'll go back a little bit with another thing about the spice mines. Lando Calrissian says in Solo, Star Wars Story, he says mining colonies are the worst. And Tobias Beckett responds, "Yeah, well, the worst is where the money is." Which again, this is the underbelly of the Star Wars universe. This is people just trying to get by, just trying to survive. But the irony here is that Lando Calrissian he's going to end up being in charge of a mining colony.
Yeah.
So, there's an interesting thing about that. I'll get to that when we talk about, like, I'll talk about Bespin and Cloud City, because there is a caveat that I think is very interesting.
Yeah, Bespin is a unique,
So,
Bespin is almost like the exception that proves the rule with what we're saying.
yes.
Yes, I would say very much so. No, I really like that quote because even Coruscant had a mine. It mines slag. Like there's just like it's everywhere in this idea of use and consumption. And we have seen this theme and metaphor used in other media and other storytelling, especially like the one that I always come back to is the Lord of the Rings in Saruman in the Two Towers when he kind of fully embraces his dark side. And he starts to build the Uruk-hai in the mine. Like he turns the beautiful land around his tower into this like place where these soldiers and this basically arm of war is built. It's a little bit disconnected from that because at the time Tolkien was trying to make, I think most people agree that he was trying to make a statement about industrialization in England at the time and like how it destroys nature. And there is something to that in the metaphors in Star Wars, but it's a little bit more into very dark side versus light side conversations. And so I just want to say like this is not an uncommon theme for literature or for storytelling in general, but it's taken on a different life in Star Wars, which I think is really fascinating.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, obviously there's real world parallels going on with how the story's told in Star Wars. But again, going back to like how Lucas was thinking about it, he wasn't necessarily drawing the, industrialization of war theme right from the get-go. And then he didn't really build on that with the Clone Wars either. He
No, he
wasn't
didn't.
saying that mining was, he was merely saying that, hey, we as men, we destroy ourselves and each other through many different ways, not just war, but also through many different types of greed and many different types of consumption. We destroy our world. So I think you wanted to say something about Schopenhauer.
Yeah, Schopenhauer is a philosopher who very much said to live is to consume.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that like that is part of life, but the light side of the force and the force in general would say consumption without rebirth and without giving back to the universe is actually the dark side. Like using without understanding that you must become one with the overall galaxy is the dark side. Schopenhauer very much said, like, to live is to consume. Like, you must consume other organisms to live. So I just wanted to point that out, that philosophy in general has an arm of it that talks about this very depressing theme that, like, the only way we exist is by consuming the lives of others, you know?
Oh, yeah. No,
Yeah.
that's really interesting because that's something that I was kind of, when I was researching this topic, I was kind of treading into because, yes, we do have to consume these non-renewable resources. But we're also finding as we consume these non-renewable resources, the reality of the fact that they are non-renewable is making us find innovative renewable resources, right?
Yeah. Or
We're
to use them,
discovering
or to use
or
them
to
again through
use them.
recycling, or,
Right.
and then that enters into an idea of rebirth, right?
Right.
That by consuming and then dying, we feed another generation of things, right? And there's
Yeah.
those kind of like our body feeds other
Yeah.
things.
Like quite literally. It's such a weird thing, but that's the reality. And again, like that's why these stories are telling, they're telling this reality through this weird way.
And how myth is actually myth of our times rather than myth of previous times is that it tells you the reality of your current life and
Yeah.
what is going on for humanity nowadays is that this is the myth of our times. This is Star Wars is the myth of our times.
Yeah,
Yeah.
totally. There's so many good themes. So we talked about spice mines and how it's not necessarily just war, but also dangerous drugs that propel this type of consumption. Because again, like as a thing that I find interesting is that man will not just destroy other men, we'll also destroy ourselves through the same drive of consumption and hunger and greed. And the next place that I kind of pointed out was Lothal. So yeah, the one another place that I found really interesting was Lothal because I'll start with the quote. So Ezra says in Rebels, he says, "What was it like to fight in the Clone War?" to Rex, and Rex responds, "Well, I don't think the fighting ever got to Lothal." So what's interesting to me about that is that it's explicitly calling out like the war did not destroy Lothal. It was the resources. It was mining. And so and the cool history about Lothal was that it actually became occupied by the Galactic Empire after it had gone through severe drought and plague. So what they did is they reached out to the galaxy and they asked for help. And of course, the Galactic Empire came along and said, "Oh, we'll help you." Because after they researched the planet, they found out that it does have Kyber mines. So when the Galactic Empire came around, they surveyed the planet. And I'm not exactly sure if the story and kind of like what the timeline was exactly, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was that they surveyed the planet, found out there were Kyber mines, and then decided that they would help Lothal, with resources like food and water and whatnot, because they had gone through such severe natural disaster. So again, that's just another, it's just showing that the reality is, yes, we do need to consume and we do need to ask for help sometimes because there are natural disasters and like the Galactic Empire is kind of this evil that goes throughout the world and takes advantage of that need and then strips the planets of all resources. So
Yeah, I would say this is actually covered quite well in the Thrawn book itself, in that Duneum and the Governor Price, when she was before she was Governor Price, actually was the daughter of a family that owned a mine in Lothal. And so she comes from Lothal and she's, a native of that location. But what is really interesting about that is that the Empire kind of takes over her mind
Yeah.
in the most evil way. I do want to point out Lost Stars as well. Lost Stars wasn't mentioned in your list as well, but the Empire came to their planet as well, the Thane and Sayana. I do not remember the name of the planet, but their home planet, and not only recruited the lives of the young people into the army, but also started to mine in the mine, like create mines to mine the natural resources from that location. So not only were they taking precious resources, they were taking the generation of their young too, which is also a consumption to do with war.
Yeah, that's it's the same thing essentially. Mm-hmm. It's the same theme. So yeah, the next one, Jakku is the only time that, so we obviously know when we meet Rey and we see Jakku for the first time, it's desolate, it's a desert, it reminds us a lot of Tatooine. However, in the other extended canon resources, we find out that it was once, it was covered with forest and water. But according to these accounts, some past calamity turned it into a barren wasteland, basically. Mm-hmm. So, and also mentioned in the Star Wars Complete Locations reference guide, it said specifically that the mining operations dotted the planet.
Yeah.
So we don't know what they were mining on Jakku. It could have been anything. It could have been Kyber. It could have been minerals. We have no idea, but it does seem very interesting that Jakku then turned into like a shipping planet, like a trade location, mm-hmm. where a lot of ships turned up, a lot of ships were, this is even before the battle over Jakku, like it was a place where they did a lot of ship repairs and mm-hmm. ship docking for some reason.
It still had used up its valuableness because it had been destroyed, yep. basically.
Yeah.
It had been consumed.
And it was
nowhere.
Gone, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it literally just became a pit stop mm-hmm. for trade vessels and whatnot. So, and,
yeah. That's very similar to Tatooine, right? Which is... if there's a bright center to the galaxy, you're on the planet that it's farthest from.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and there's another weird thing about Jakku I forgot to put in my notes, but in the Legends of Luke Skywalker, the legend about Jakku that happens has the sinking sands, just like we see like with Finn and the TIE fighter.
Yeah.
In The Force Awakens, but in the Legends Luke Skywalker story, the sands turn into like almost like glass because they get so hot and everything is sinking into them. So I do wonder if that'll be kind of parsed out a little bit more in future stories, that the mining apparatus that was created underneath the surface of Jakku, maybe there's something happening under the surface that is turning the sand to glass and like heating it up.
There was like a fire or something that turned it into a molten lake of glass. I just recently reread that story with my son, so it was like a fire.
Yeah, in the legends.
Yeah. But
they call it the sinking sands of Jakku.
Yeah. Yeah. There. So, I mean, yeah. Maybe they've mined so much underneath that there's actually like, basically.
Sinkholes,
yeah, because of it.
Yeah.
I still wonder about Jakku, and I think this is a good time to bring it up. What is it about Jakku?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, why does, to quote Finn, why does everyone want to go back to Jakku? We don't know what's going on in Jakku.
Yeah.
Yeah, like...
There's weird stuff. Like, there is still the weird mention of the magnetic fields, but I've been reading more about that, and I have to say I think it comes from legends. Like, unless you were to ask Jason Fry explicitly like why he included something about the magnetic fields, the magnetic fields, and he says something different, I think it comes from legends, because the magnetic fields was apparently the way that legends books figured out how the science of certain types of levitation works with, not levitation, but like, well, yeah, like how certain ships fly and hover in certain spaceports. So they said that just like how the Kyber crystal and just like how the lightsaber suspends that line of plasma, right, how it holds that in place, it's magnetic fields. So they said the same kind of thing happens with like planets.
But you were referring to the line where Jason Fry specifically says that Rey can feel the magnetic field of like the weaponry that the Praetorian guards are holding. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's fighting them, and she says it reminded her of the magnetic fields around Jakku. And I think both of us were like, why are there magnetic fields around Jakku? Because
so weird.
There's nothing there. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so, and there's the weird incident of the fact that the ships literally fell from the sky so easily.
Yes.
In the Battle of Jakku.
Exactly.
And that's still like a mystery in Star Wars, which is kind of interesting. So maybe mines have something to do with that. Like whatever is the mechanisms under the surface of Jakku, we don't know.
Right. I love how this is like such a fanboy topic. Like we're so obsessed with these things, right? Usually I always make fun of guys for getting so hooked on the things. I'm like, oh, but you're missing the theme, you're missing the bigger picture, and here I am getting so obsessed with like the thing of magnetic fields and what's under Jakku. You know, who is Snoke? Is Snoke the prime Jedi? Da, 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 da. That's the kind of stuff that I always make fun of, but here I am doing it, you know?
Well, and I think that it just would help us understand a little bit more about the theme of Rey coming from nowhere, you know?
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's what it is. Like
maybe it wasn't actually nowhere, or maybe it is actually nowhere, right? We don't know what the import of going to Jakku was. We know that the Emperor wanted his fleet to go there to have this final battle. This was like the standoff. Well, the backup plan in some ways with Galax Rax,
right,
and with Rey Sloan.
Right.
We just don't know. We don't know why. And that right. That drives me personally crazy. I don't know the motivations of the people who are making decisions.
Right.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's for the same, like there's another weird thing that happens with Jedha. Actually, I'll go on to talk about Jedha too, because this is a weird thing. The decision that was made with Jedha during the writing of Rogue One was that the kyber crystals on Jedha did not get there because they are inherently a natural resource of Jedha. They apparently got there because of an asteroid. This is like one of those tidbits that was revealed by one of the creators in like some random interview. But the city of Jedha is, remember in that one shot from above, it's surrounded by like a wall.
Yeah.
And it looks kind of sunken in. Apparently that was supposed to look like it was hit by an asteroid. And that asteroid is actually what brought the kyber crystals to the planet. That was the only place. Yeah. So That's really weird. But also, right before they destroyed Jedha, one of the people on the Death Star said, hey, like, I want to destroy the moon, like the moon next to Jedha. And they said, no, we're going to destroy the planet because we need to make an example of the fact that like there are rebels there that are trying to fight us.
Yeah.
And though it was going to destroy the rest of the Kyber.
Yeah.
So I find that really interesting. I don't know why. Again, these are just things that like they're decisions that have been made for reasons that I don't know if they're important or not. So I just want to like make those notes and then look for them in the future. When people go back, and maybe they don't mean anything now, but maybe people will go back and they're writing extended canon and they'll be like, hey, this is interesting. And they ask the story group, okay, did you guys mean anything by this? The story group says, well, no. And they say, okay, well, can I mean something by this?
Yeah, exactly. Can this mean
kind
something?
Of,
yeah.
Can this mean something? And they can expand upon that. So I just want to look out for those kinds of things in the future. So, but anyways, so back to like, Jedha, obviously we know like Galactic Empire mined Jedha for the creation of the Death Star, for Kyber.
So I think that it's important to say, like, okay, so this is just a few key examples, but the Empire itself goes to a planet, and this happened in the Ahsoka novelization. This happens in almost every single novel that we have read and almost every single show. When the Empire goes to a location, it's because it wants something from that planet as
Absolutely. As
something to consume, to add into the overall control and to drive the engine of war, right? Or to drive the engine of control and hunger.
Right.
Because the hunger by the dark side is never consumed, it or never fulfilled, because you cannot be fulfilled by not having a natural process. And that's the point, is that the dark side is about consumption. It's about using up the resources by which can never be replenished. Whereas mm-hmm. the light side is more about trying to figure out what the balance is between consumption and renewal.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I do want to expand on that a little bit after I've said the rest of the examples, because this is, I think this is exactly what this whole theme is all about. The First Order continues on, like, the Galactic Empire and what they're trying to do. Like, the First Order is doing the same thing, but they're doing it in a lot, like, sneakier way.
Yes.
So they're going out to the Outer Rim planets. They're going out to, like, the far reaches of the galaxy, and they're finding resources in ways that are, like, it's very innovative what they're doing. They're not just going to planets and, like, stealing the children, and, you know, obviously they're doing that, but, like, they're going to asteroids. They're finding asteroids, and they are hollowing them out and creating space stations out of them.
It's a little bit more insidious, right? Because it's like they're leaving behind their control, not just consuming. Whereas, like, the Empire would consume for the sake of consuming and then would leave a dead planet. They would kill the resources. If the humans ended up dying in the process, they wouldn't care. Whereas the First Order is almost transforming planets into them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's actually a really good point. Theta Station Black is that. It's, well, and of course, something happened to it. So, yeah, but.
what is Theta Station Black?
And I'll try not to give spoilers of it, but yeah, Theta Station Black is a First Order base that was created out of an asteroid, because they were hollowing it out to get metals for their blasters. And I think that's all they were getting. Correct me if I'm wrong, but a big part of it was that it was kind of a secret. They were kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It was like camouflage, like in the middle of nowhere, like it looked like an mm-hmm. asteroid kind of thing. So yeah, tell us more about it.
Right. Theta Station Black was where it was actually an episode that happened in Resistance, where Kaz and Poe end up investigating, trying to figure out, you know, hey, what's going on here? And they built the First Order built a full base there. And instead of allowing Kaz and Poe to kind of investigate it or understand it, truthfully, the First Order found out that Poe had visited it and ended up destroying the whole thing, rather than have the Resistance or have the New Republic find out anything that they were up to.
So do you think there's more that we don't know that was going on there?
Probably. There's probably something else that was happening there. I think,
like, probably just like files on computers or whatever.
Yeah, it could have been a training facility, or it could have been like the thing that the First Order at this point in time with the Resistance is that it's almost like Leia has the heebie-jeebies, and so she creates an entire guerrilla group around having the heebie-jeebies about the First Order. Nobody else believes that the First Order is a threat.
Yeah,
at this point in the story.
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
Yeah, like what Leia has done is entirely on her own reputation, created a group of rebels. So this is, you know, the 6 months before The TFA. Force Awakens. Yeah. And she's created this group of rebels of guerrilla fighters almost to basically just understand what the First Order knows and how they know it and what they're doing, because nobody mm-hmm. knows what they're doing. And the First Order was born out of not only the remnants of the Empire, but also the worlds that were less than excited about the idea of a centralized government. Yeah. Right.
Interesting.
Or no, yeah, not a centralized government. They wanted a strong, powerful centralized government. They were called the centrists in Bloodline.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. And the first order like goes about like, they go about, like I said earlier, they go about what they're doing a lot differently than what the Galactic Empire has been doing because they're doing it in secret. And another thing that they do is they go and they find a source for Kyber out in the unknown regions. We only know this because it's explicitly stated that they're using Kyber for their turbo lasers in like one of the books. And it explicitly states in another book in the Force Awakens Incredible Cross Sections reference guide that they found these are so weird. I don't know how they come up with this and how they like keep all this organized, but it's
all in the holocron. That's
right.
It's all in the holocron. Leland knows all.
It's basically said that they're mining the Kyber from somewhere in the unknown region. So the First Order basically found another planet other than Lothal, other than Ilum, that has Kyber. So that's really interesting. So a couple more. Bespin and the Cloud City. This goes back to Lando, right? So the irony of Lando is that he said that he hated, you know, mining colonies. Mining colonies are the worst in Solo. But as we meet him originally in the original trilogy, he is actually in charge of Cloud City, which is a mining colony because they mine gas. This is the weird thing though, right? Because they're gas mining. And gas, we think, is probably a renewable resource. It kind of goes along with like what I'm thinking about the mining is that if it's a depletable resource, then it's a theme for the dark side, being unable to control your hunger and consuming it to the point where you deplete it. Whereas there is a way to consume renewable resources. And I think gas might be one of those renewable resources, or at least this particular type of gas on Bespin. So just something interesting.
What's super interesting is like he not only is in charge of Bespin during the original trilogy, but during Last Shot, he's back being in charge of Bespin. So after he leaves, like Empire Strikes Back and runs away and like helps out for that year and a half or whatever that he's with the Rebel Alliance kind of solving the galaxy's problems, you know, really they just needed Lando the whole time. They needed Lando the whole time. And then as soon as Lando comes in, you know, hey, we resolved everything.
They win. We won.
He actually comes back. And in Last Shot, he's in charge of Bespin again. Mm-hmm. And he has a cape closet. I'm sure that's why he moved into Bespin, was so that he had more room for his capes. They need air, they need circulation, they need proper hangers, right? This is a thing.
So it's really funny, like I was thinking about like Bespin and Cloud City and kind of like how it looks, and if you look at the mining, not just the mining facilities, but also the houses and everything like that, they're all shaped like mushrooms, with the stem that goes down. And the science of Cloud City and most of Bespin is that, you know, the top is where everybody lives, and that's in the inhabitable layer of the atmosphere where there's oxygen, so you can like be outside and whatnot. But as soon as you start going down into that stem goes all the way down into like the inhabitable region where they actually do the mining for the gas.
Yeah.
And that part, like the part of the bottom of that building, actually helps collect the gas. So it's just interesting to me that, I mean, obviously I think Lando probably disliked mining because he didn't like the idea of being underground. And so he never really had to do that because he was always above ground. But it was like
he's just a bureaucrat at that point. Right?
So like, interesting.
Yeah. Like, and he cared about the people that lived in the facility, right? So it's different. It's got a whole different feel than what we get with the Empire, which is they don't care about the local populace. His whole goal, when we know that the Empire is up to no good in Bespin, is that he actually, like, says, like, you know, the Empire's taking control. You better get out of here.
Yeah. Again, and there's no slaves, like you're saying, like there's no slaves on Bespin. So that's another theme, is that a lot of these places that are depleting their resources, they're making people slaves to collect that resource as well. Which brings us to Legends of Luke Skywalker and the ultimate metaphor for all of this, which is probably the gem.
Yeah, the gem. Yeah, I would say.
And I'll tell you. Like,
oh, I just want to make one comment, which is that Ken Liu's book is very much how I have framed a lot of my thoughts on Star Wars. And I don't mean to say that in like, oh, everyone should read this book, but it helps me almost order many of the things that I see in the Star Wars universe. And I'm very lucky to have had the opportunity to speak with him about, you know, myth and how these stories are created, and about what he was trying to go for, because the only way that you can tell these stories is through multiple lenses, because the truth of Star Wars is so complex but yet so simple, in that it is the story of humanity. If you are able to view it from multiple angles and it still holds true, maybe that's actually something that is true for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Like, and Fishy in the Deluge, that story, they specifically comment there's nothing of interest in the planet that the Empire would have, any of the empires of the past would have wanted to consume. I just wanted to point that out before you go into the iDroid. Like,
no, I love that
conversation.
I didn't realize that was in the Deluge story. How cool is that?
It's in the first.
Oh my God.
It's in the first paragraph as she's kind of describing the narrator at the time, who we assume is close to first person, you know, as we can get. She's telling the story of her home planet and about Luke and about, you know, this incident that happened. But she specifically says that the planet is of no use to anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I do remember that now. Yeah. Of course it needed to be explained why it was such a paradise, I think. And that's why it's the Galactic Empire didn't come there.
It had fish. That's what it had. Water had fish, and fish.
Yeah. How cool is that? So I think the gem is kind of like this weird, like big metaphor for like what mining really is. And I'm going to say this again, it's not just about war. The gem people poo-pooed on war. They did not like the idea of war. We talked about this a lot in our, in our dissection of the book, Legends of Luke Skywalker. I get so hung up on this particular story because of this, because of the gem and the existence of the idea of the gem, even if it's not real. I just find it such an interesting metaphor. These are scholars. These are people, artists. They're people who are trying to create things. And they are doing it on the backs of slaves, mostly droids, that are mining something called opals.
They're tier opals.
And tier opals.
Yes.
And tier opals are not anything. They're nothing. Like, they're not Kyber. They're not like some kind of precious metal. We've never heard of them before. They're not even listed on they're not in canon. Like, it's not.
No,
a canon
this is all this thing. Is all legend. But I think that the quality of tier opals is the pain of the galaxy. That it is the pain that is produced. Yes, it's tears. It is literally the suffering that the gem is able to exist because of the suffering that is pulled out of the mine.
Yeah, that's the metaphor. That it's the ultimate metaphor of what mining is for the Star Wars universe. And I think a lot, what we talked a lot about last time was we talked a lot about, like, you know, the parallel and the symbolism of the characters and who they were in the sequel trilogy and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I'm now, and I think I even stated when we were talking about that, I was like, I still don't know how to wrap my head around this, but I think I'm actually getting it now.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, this theme, it comes up all the time. And this is, it's not Kyber. It's not about the thing. It's about the theme.
Yeah. It's that no matter what the resource is,
right,
it is the mining and the what the action is the suffering that is put on the people allows for the people and the planet itself, because this is very, like, you know, consumption versus nature, right? And yeah. what is the right way to consume versus what is, you know, more in harmony with nature. And right. The idea that that they only pull the pain out of the ground to yeah. support the utopian society that is above is the point.
Yeah, that exactly.
In amongst the Star Wars, the people that live, you know, on Canto Bight or in, you know, in the upper apartments of Coruscant, anyone is standing on the backs of the pain of the galaxy and ignoring the fact that they are, you know, only able to exist because of that. But in their minds, they feel like they're justified because of
yeah.
the things that they're contributing to the galaxy.
Yes, 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 exactly. Which is, again, it takes us from the normal, what we think Star Wars is normally, which is that there are bad people and there are good people. It's like, well, that's not that simple. Life is not that yeah. simple.
Yeah, there's complex stuff going on in our galaxy far, far away. And if you start to dig into it, it asks very difficult existential and philosophical questions that we as humanity have been struggling, you know, our whole lives as yeah. humans. Like, you know, what is the right thing to do? You know, mm-hmm. are you a Nietzschean philosopher, the strong will rule, you know, or yeah. are you a Schopenhauer that this is just what the curse of humanity is to consume, being mm-hmm. alive is to consume. Are you, you know, more of a Hegelian or a Humean who, you know, would say that there is something that is actually right about the world?
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, these questions that we ask ourselves without actually asking them and seeing them in fiction helps us process these very complex human questions.
Yeah. And a lot of people look at these themes of, like, the mining themes and whatnot, and they say, oh, this is just another environmental message. This is just another, like, mining is bad. Taking from the ground is bad.
This isn't James, you know, James Cameron coming to Alberta to tell us that we shouldn't have oil sands. No, I would say that it's not. It's actually more of an understanding that you need to be aware of the world that you live in
mm-hmm.
morally, first and foremost. And once you're aware of that, it helps.
Well, yes. And I think, like, there is an obvious, like, environmental message, but the environmental message is, like, that you should be living with your world, not just on your world. Right.
Yeah. But that's, that goes for dealing with other humans.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's everything.
Be an active part of your ecosystem. So this is so funny, because if you've read, which we have, but if anybody listening, another story in the Legends of Luke Skywalker was the Exogorth story. And the Exogorth story was really interesting, because Luke had such a problem being in the Exogorth and killing things inside of it. This is the space worm, because he wasn't a part of that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was interacting with those things, he didn't have the knowledge he needed to feel like he was, he felt like he was contributing negatively consistently to that ecosystem. So his only thought was he needed to get out of it, because he couldn't live within that system. He was doing only bad by living in that system. It's very interesting. So that was a very explicit, like, environmental message. However, that's like, obviously that was like one theme of that one story that was very like environmental. But if you look at it from like how Luke was processing what was happening and how he was trying to find solutions, like the Exogorth was killing him and the other person.
Yeah.
When they were in it. And their only way out was through like this really weird way to connect with the Force, which we don't need to get into, but they were able to get out without hurting the
Exogorth worm. Yeah.
So yeah. So going back to like kind of the whole theme about this whole thing is just that there's the quick and easy path, and then there's the not quick and easy path.
Yeah.
And the not quick and easy path is, it's like I said in my notes, it's not about the thing, it's about the theme. It's more difficult to cultivate, harvest, love, understand, you know, figure out, study. It's so hard, especially in the face of natural disasters,
pain.
Especially in the face of pain,
struggle, strife. Exactly. What Anakin is going through with his bad dreams about Padme's death, it's hard to connect with other people during that time, but that's what you need to do to avoid long-term suffering, right? Because if you choose the quick and easy path, it is the dark side. And mining is just another metaphor for that in the Star Wars universe.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes. So that's our conversation on mining. And I think we did a pretty good overview of all of the instances. You can go out there and like just search it everywhere. It's everywhere in especially Disney canon. They definitely bring it up. So it is something for you to pay attention to. And now that you have been told about it, I'm sure you will not be able to unsee it. Much like us.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. True. So this has been the Power of Myth and Symbolism episode on mining. Ty, where can people find you?
Yeah, they can find me at black_TYM on Twitter, and you can find me at Wit and Folly on YouTube. And I also have a podcast about Asian dramas called Fall For It.
Which I'm occasionally on.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
I'll promote it on here because Marie Claire is on it.
Yeah.
It's at fallforit_drama.
Yes. Yes, you should definitely check it out,
Twitter.
Especially if you like Asian dramas and you want to check out maybe a different form of storytelling. I would say Asian dramas tell such unique stories for us North Americaners that like they're romantic and they deal with change journeys from a character perspective, and they're very satisfying. So check out some.
Absolutely.
And then listen to Fall For It.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I thought I would add in a little bit of a end discussion just with my own thoughts on two books that I've read recently. And I wasn't sure when I could fit these in or if I could do a big discussion with another person. So I thought I would bring them in, and I feel like they're very important. So I wanted to make sure that you at least heard my thoughts. The two books will be E.K. Johnson's Queen's Shadow and Claudia Gray's Master and Apprentice. Additionally, I think that we're going to see a tie-in potentially, or at least that these three books, including Kevin Scott's Dooku Jedi Lost, will all kind of, it's interesting that they all kind of came out at like within 2 months of each other. E.K. Johnson's book came out at the beginning of March. Claudia Gray's book just came out here right after Celebration, and we have Kevin Scott's coming out this week as this episode is coming out. Kevin Scott's book is what I would consider a bridge between an audiobook and a audio drama. And if you've listened to Fangirls, you know that I'm exploring the world of audio dramas myself, and it is, you know, the clips that we've heard are very good. It seems to have a lot of narration associated with it. And it, according to the brief synopsis that we've received, it seems to not only talk about the relationship between Asajj and Dooku, but explores the past of Dooku a fair amount. And we don't really know much about that at this point, but I'm going to probably do a review discussion of it as soon as I can. And I'm really excited based on the clips. And it's a new media to explore, because even though we have audiobooks, this one was specifically written as a script and is, I would say, more in the line of Ian Dorsch's William Shakespeare's Star Wars rather than, say, maybe an audiobook, like something that Claudia Gray would do and then be produced like an audiobook. I'm really excited for Star Wars to go off into that new direction. It feels like we're going further back in time with each of these three books. And I just want to talk about them, the two that I have read thus far. And then, you know, again, with plans to discuss the third one as soon as I can when that comes up. So the first, of course, is Queen's Shadow. And it is sort of the most forward from a canon perspective. It takes place between The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. So, you know, just as Queen Padme Amidala is stepping down from her initial reign as queen. I'm going to go into full spoilers for this whole thing. So if you haven't read the book, you really want to read it without any spoilers, or Master and Apprentice, you know, feel free to tune out and come back later if you're interested in my thoughts. Queen Shadow is a really fascinating book. I really appreciated all of the mask references and sort of almost full mythology of wearing a mask and taking on a different persona and having the power of the queen, this role, this inherited role in some ways, the inheritance of this power that Amidala takes on. And in some ways, Padme herself steps into this role and facilitates it, right? But also her handmaidens also step into this role and facilitate the role. And together, not just her and her handmaidens, they all participate in the shared power that the makeup and the regalia create and the whole process. I very much think that Ben Solo, Kylo Ren, is a lot like his grandmother. And I think that was purposefully done. The trailer for 9 really makes me think this idea of a decoy maneuver from Kylo. So, you know, maybe he's got too much of his grandmother in him. I kind of like that idea. There's a lot of comparison to how she feels, Padme herself feels like a shadow of herself. She uses the mask and the assumptions about her to find out more information. She's such an interesting person in this book. And I'm very thankful for this book to exist and that we actually get to see inside of Padme's head. The other half of this book is, you know, Sabé and the other handmaidens and the women that live in the Queen's Shadow. But really all of the women, including Padme, are sometimes the shadow of this persona, of this role. And as she moves into being a senator, they take on, you know, they continue on this decoy and protection protocol. And, you know, she has some cool stuff like these battle dresses and, you know, the secret pockets. And it's part like amazing female James Bond or like superhero or like Kim Possible kind of idea. Like it's really cool, the idea of this. The only question I have for E.K. Johnson, if she ever listens to this podcast, is why does this exist? Like, what is the story? I want to hear the story about why the decoy maneuver exists, because theoretically, you know, Naboo is supposed to be this, I don't know, paradise, this utopian society where democracy actually works and, you know, people get along and there's art and it's preferred that you become an artist to a politician, which, you know, feels very fantasy-like and utopian. But we have to remember that this is Palpatine's home planet. And what does that mean? You know, maybe there's actually powerful darkness within the powerful light. I don't know. Just some stuff to think about. I really loved the book. It made me want to get more content from this time. I want to learn more about each of the handmaidens individually. Sabe especially seems to have potentially a second story that could be written out of that. I love the symmetry of the full journey that Padme experiences with the prologue and epilogue of her floating in the water, and that very much representing her future state as she is in her coffin. That was beautifully written. I felt like there was some, and this is just a minor critique because overall, like, the book is glorious and makes me want more. There were some pacing issues near the end. And why this book still ties into the topic of today's episode is really fascinating, is that Padme is singularly focused on eliminating slavery from the galaxy. And that is something, slavery and like the power of the dark side, you know, in some ways, like these tools that are used up and ground up, like the mining metaphor that we just spoke about in this episode with Ty. I think that's really fascinating that this is especially being used. So they're, you know, herself as well as her handmaiden Sabe specifically tried to change this through multiple means, through going after and freeing slaves, through, you know, specifically changing the laws, accompanying a group of relief effort, because she knows that people are less likely to be abused if they are, you know, treated fairly and have relief aid, and, you know, they're less likely to turn to crime and all of those things. Like, she is very much a humanitarian and very much a good person, and she sees all the angles. And I think that that's the most important part. We also get some good references to Qui-Gon Jinn as being somebody that she trusted and had a very interesting relationship with. And then, like, a month and a half later, we get this book that's like very much focused on Qui-Gon Jinn, his Padawan, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and his relationship with his master, Count Dooku, or at the time, just Dooku, Master Dooku, and his other apprentice, Rael Averroes. So moving into Master and Apprentice, and Master and Apprentice happens before The Phantom Menace. Obi-Wan Kenobi is 17 years old. He is a difficult teenager. Claudia has written an excellent book. Mwah, chef's kiss. It's glorious. And it covers some incredibly fascinating force things, force topics. It breaks out some very unique and interesting, I don't know, ways of thinking about the Force and like how people slip, you know, and how people fall into traps because they don't communicate and they don't truthfully say what they need, you know? And the best examples of that are actually between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon throughout the book. They don't communicate well, and so they don't coordinate well. They don't collaborate, you know. And Yoda actually even calls this out very early on in the book after their first mission is a complete failure. Qui-Gon is blaming himself as a mentor, and he's like, I'm a terrible master. It's all my fault that Obi-Wan isn't successful and we're not getting along. And Yoda's like, it takes two to have a relationship. And what I find very fascinating about this book is that at some point, Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon get to the point where they are comrades rather than master and apprentice. And it's actually pointed out in the epilogue as Obi-Wan is talking and thinking about Qui-Gon and their relationship and how they had just kind of gotten over the pain of their initial years and the awkwardness of not being able to get along. And the key to their relationship was being able to see the truth and the power in both of them, you know? And once they got to the point where it was a partnership rather than necessarily an off-balanced power struggle, which unfortunately, like with masters and apprentices, there's always going to be this power change. It really makes me think that they might be going to a place with, I don't know, maybe nine, I'm just going to speculate for a moment, where, you know, no longer master and apprentice, like this number two, you know, maybe it's more like you're paired up and you have a partner, you know, a true partner. I think that might be an interesting change. I've always, you know, we've speculated about this on previous episodes about why the number two, why is there only two Sith, you know, why is there only two in the master apprentice relationship? And I really struggle with the master apprentice relationship because although it seems very important, it's very much like journeymanship, like learning your trade, right? Learning what you are and who you are. It seems like almost a callback to, in some ways, slavery, you know? And I know that it's been brought up in other canon pieces, like in Clone Wars, like, you know, what's the difference, you know, between having a master, a Jedi person and a you know, master who's just a slave keeper, you know? And I know that, like, fundamentally how you're treated and all of those things, but having that hierarchy also kind of creates some theoretical problems too, right? Like, Anakin, when he was freed from being a slave, immediately went back into being bound into service. And Qui-Gon in Master and Apprentice very much questions whether anybody in the Jedi Order ever had a chance to make a true decision of whether they should actually be there. And they haven't. Rael Averroes was one of the oldest that they had ever taken in, you know, before Anakin. And he was 5. And he retained a lot of his ways about him from, you know, having 5 years of life before joining the Jedi Order. And he was almost considered to be too old to join. And it really is an interesting question. And I think that what they're going to have to go to is this idea that, you know, maybe choosing children when they're babies, not such a good idea. Separating them from their families, also not a great idea. Taking them away from everything they love, not great. And it has to be something of a free will choice to go and pursue, you know? And I just feel like that's the change that's coming because of the overall theme of consumption and then mastery and using, you know, slavery and how it ties to the Jedi Order. Like, it's just, it's really interesting. And slavery and mining, and especially finding these, like, gems is a big theme in Master and Apprentice. So, you know, and the idea that slavery can exist even in theoretically, like, democratic societies that have outlawed it with the Zerka Corporation, and they mine they mine all over the place, and people use the fruits of that mine for different reasons, right? But specifically in Master and Apprentice, we have these two jewel entrepreneurs. We have Pax and we have Rahara, and they are now my new ship. I love them so much. Paxara all the way. Great, great, great chemistry. I can't wait to hear more stories about them. Everything ends up okay for them. We also have this amazing character, Princess Vanry, who ends up becoming queen momentarily. She's also really cool. I really loved her arc specifically in the story. But one thing that Master and Apprentice did for me above and all was make me think that, oh, wow, this mining metaphor is actually like very, very true in all of the canon books almost, including this one. You know, there's this kyber that isn't kyber called the Kulan crystals, and the Jedi's find this and it has its own uses, which is really, really interesting. You know, can be used in a lightsaber, but it's weaker than a regular kyber crystal and it shines with a different light. Really cool stuff, you know. And I wanted to just briefly read the prophecies that we heard in the book and discuss them a little tiny bit. I definitely recommend reading it. It's really fascinating and interesting and gave me a lot to think about. So we got quite a few prophecies. A few were repeated, but we got, she who is born to darkness will give birth to darkness. We got, when the Kyber that is not Kyber shines forth, the time of prophecy is at hand. We also got, when the righteous lose the light, evil once dead will return. Huh. And then we got this whole Chosen One nonsense, which that's how Obi-Wan refers to the Chosen One prophecy. Although only through the sacrifice of many Jedi will the Order cleanse the sin done to the Nameless. Ooh, what's that all about? And then, the danger of the past is not past, but sleeps in an egg. And when the egg cracks, it will threaten the entire galaxy. When the Force itself sickens, the past and the future must split and combine. The Sith would disappear, yet appear again. And he who learns to conquer death will, through his greatest student, live again. Oh boy. Huh. So much going on there. Where do I even begin? I'm just going to guess at what these things mean. And you know what? Prophecy is a weird thing. I could be wrong with what these things mean. The Kyber that is not Kyber that shines forth, the time of prophecy is at hand. We seem to discover through the course of the book that the Kulan crystals, which appear to be like Kyber crystals that are not, that shine in certain lights, Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, well, primarily Qui-Gon, who believes in prophecy and believes that he has been chosen to help participate in the time of prophecy, very much believes that this happened in the book. And there is evidence that it did happen. She who is born to darkness will give birth to darkness. To me, the most obvious choice of this is that it's Leia. You know, she was born of Anakin and gave birth to Ben. Reincarnation, maybe? That would be fascinating. When the righteous lose the light, evil once dead will return. Could this be Sidious? Palpatine? I mean, maybe. What does losing the light mean? Only through sacrifice of many Jedi will the Order cleanse the sin done to the Nameless. I feel like this one is a point to maybe the past, maybe something that had happened in the past, and something about the Order in its current state, the Jedi Order in its current state, is against what should be. That's all I got. When the Force itself sickens, the past and the future must split and combine. This one gives me the feel of how the dark side and the Force is almost clouded and sick and is not doing well, right? During the prequel era, like the Jedi Council talk about how their ability to use the Force is diminished. They're not able to see things as well. And the past and the future must split and combine. I feel like this is saying something about how, you know, the saga is going to conclude and we're going to have clues from, you know, the Star Wars saga, the Skywalker saga is about, you know, mending the sins of the mistakes of the past and bringing them into the future to understand and rectify, you know? And I feel like we might get some really cool perhaps, you know, connections to Padme and to Anakin and how that all went down. The Sith would disappear yet reappear again. So it that feels like maybe the return of the Sith from their quiet machinations could also refer to Palpatine coming back in episode 9. We don't know, in The Rise of Skywalker. He who learns to conquer death will, through his greatest student, live again. Another Palpatine one, maybe? I don't know. It gives me a lot to think about. And there's some really interesting quotes that I just want to bring up just to kind of tie this into a little bit of a bow. Qui-Gon muses on the prophecies themselves, and Qui-Gon says, a true vision of the future is a simultaneous perception of two points in time, both now and the future. And I really like this quote a lot. He talks a lot about how he is a collector of experiences because he only has, that's the only thing that he can truly have. And he collects pebbles and things from places he's visited. But, and actually that comes into play in the book as a really nice tie back. But it's really fascinating to say that because eventually when he becomes a Force ghost, all he is his memories. You know, all he is the things that he has experienced. I would say it's a very healthy way to live, is to live and collect experiences rather than maybe things. It's also a very, you know, in line with a compassionate worldview, you know. You certainly don't have avarice if you collect experiences rather than collecting things. Yeah. I really, really loved this book. And I think that the things that we learned about Dooku in it really set us up to potentially what we'll be learning in Dooku. So I'm very much looking forward to digging into that and learning all about it. And I will do a deep dive into it as soon as I can. So thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope to hear back from everybody about what they thought of our mind metaphor and what it all means. So take care, everyone.
I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is orchestral music composed by Christy Carew. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We would like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love What the Force, In Wild Space, Night Huntress, and Susan. We are available wherever podcasts are found and YouTube. You can connect with us at Twitter at WT4Show or on Facebook at What the Force. Feel free to reach out to us and start a conversation. Cheers.